This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
We get the best start to the day because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
Good morning, folks. There is a heavy agenda this week at the state legislature. A number of bills addressing the insurance crisis that we've been experiencing in the state of Louisiana for some period of time. And joining us is Clancy Dubose, political editor and columnist for Gambit and WWL, Louisiana political analyst, joins us to talk about same. Clancy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Newell. Good to be with you again.
Clancy, you've opined many times about where we find ourselves relative to this insurance crisis and some of the remedial legislation that's put into place. What has happened thus far, and has this changed any of your thinking as to the path that we're headed down?
Well, you know, every governor and every legislature attempts to put its mark on this problem. It's been a problem for a while, as you know. We've had among the nation's highest auto insurance rates for decades. And the two sides being plaintiff attorneys who they get labeled as trial lawyers or, you know, they're really defense lawyers are also trial lawyers because they try cases. Okay. So, but the people generically referred to as trial lawyers, which are people who represent people injured in accidents, on one side, and then the other side is insurance companies. You know, it's in various times we've had legislatures that and governors who sided with the attorneys and the plaintiffs, people injured, and they've had people side with the insurance companies. And also stuck in the middle are everybody in Louisiana who, you know, nobody wants to see themselves get injured and not get, you know, remunerated for their injuries or their property and personal, you know, injuries and pain that they've suffered. But at the same time, nobody wants to pay sky high insurance rates. So it's a tough balance to try to achieve. Other states managed to do it, but somehow that has escaped Louisiana. And, you know, what's happening now is the governor and the legislature are all, we have a two-thirds supermajority of Republican conservatives in the legislature, and we have a conservative Republican governor, and we have a conservative Republican commissioner of insurance. And yet, for some reason, they can't seem to agree on what the solution is. The governor, Governor Landry, is, you know, anxious to see Louisiana adopt what's called tort reform, which is a term coined by insurance companies. It's adjusting the laws that govern how much people can sue for, how much they can recover in a lawsuit, everything from the procedural stuff like what's the deadline for filing a lawsuit to what can be admitted as evidence to what cannot be admitted as evidence, and who you can sue, whether you can sue the insurance companies directly or not, and how much you get for pain and suffering, how much you can collect for medicals. It's very technical and very detail-oriented, but all of it, you know, you and I like to say, Newell, that there's no such thing as an unimportant election. I think we could also agree that there's no detail involving litigation rules, especially when it comes to plaintiff claims for auto accidents, that is insignificant. Every little word in those laws means a great deal. And so they fight over these things constantly. And you're right, I've covered this thing since the 80s at least, and it's they never seem to solve it. They keep passing, quote, tort reform in one form or another, but the rates keep going up. So what's happening right now is the governor although he, you know, styles himself, rightly so in many ways, as a pro-business governor, he sides with the trial lawyers, the plaintiff lawyers, on a lot of issues like this. He points the finger at insurance companies and says they're the ones to blame. They're greedy, the profits are too high, et cetera, and which is what the lawyers say. And then Tim Temple, our insurance commissioner, says, no, we need to bring our rules for governing lawsuits for personal injuries into line with those of other states. And it's really interesting to watch, because among the things that the governor is pushing is a bill that would allow the commissioner of insurance basically to be a one person, one man or one woman setter of insurance rates. And Temple, I think, rightly says, look, that opens the door to all kinds of corruption. Not that he intends to be corrupt, but we had three insurance commissioners in a row go to jail for corruption when the insurance commissioner had more power. So that's something to think about. And but it also puts the hat on, metaphorically, it puts the hat or puts the commissioner under the gun. So if the rates go up, the governor can point to the commissioner and say, see, it's his fault. There was an editorial cartoon in the paper yesterday, I think, or the day before, about Walt Handelsman to that effect. So, you know, so they and the governor and Mr. Temple have conflicting legislative packages, and they're going to be working their way through in one form or another the legislature. And just to put a final, you know, a couple of details in this landscape here, the legislature, although it is more than two-thirds Republican and conservative in each chamber, the House and Senate, a lot of the Republicans or a number of the Republicans are trial lawyers themselves. So it's not a bright line, no Republican, conservative, pro-business, pro-insurance company. It's not like that. It's a complex amalgam of interests and opinions and attitudes and suspicions and blaming all going on at one time. I hope that makes sense.
No, no doubt. I mean, my big issue with House Bill 576, which is kind of the crux of this ideological warfare that's going on between the insurance commissioner and the governor, is I think you would agree, anytime you have expansive discretionary authority, there's a fine line between that and being arbitrary, right? When you some objective criteria right. by which to judge something by. Insurance companies are into business to make money. I mean, we all know that. I mean, we have to come to grips with that. How much? That's an argument for another day. But that leads to what the matrix or whatever would be utilized to decide whether or not they're entitled to one or not. You know, in this state, you don't have a choice. You're supposed to have insurance.
Right. And that's a good thing. We should have, you know, it's sure. driving, as we both can agree on, we agree on almost everything. But I mean, you know, driving, this is not really an opinion. It's a fact. Driving is a privilege. It's not a right. So you have to, you know, earn the privilege, right? You have to qualify. And because it's a privilege, I think the state rightly, and I think most states rightly, require people to have insurance. So, you know,
the one thing that I always wonder.
Pay for it.
Yeah, you know, the one criteria that I always look at, I hear about all these other states. You know, and I look.
I'm sorry, Newell,
I
you
look
dropped
at,
out for a second. I don't know if it's my connection or yours, but
What I was saying is, we all hear the same rhetoric. I look at other states and I try to draw a direct line from the passage of legislation to reduce insurance rates. But what I find there when you folks are holding them up as an example of this expansive discretionary authority, it's not as expansive as we really believe, because most of the insurance companies fall on the side of some matrix that they look at, you know, the loss runs, right. loss ratios, things of that nature, that is objective in nature. In making that decision. But what what I've never seen a study on, and I'm curious whether you have, because you've been covering this a long time. Louisiana has a large portion of its population medically uninsured. 30% Medicaid recipients.
Right.
You know, and the other day they were saying that where we are an outlier are small claims, bodily injury claims. And I'm wondering if that's driven by they have no medical coverage. So they almost have to go to court, you know, to get whatever their injury may be. And, you know, and because health insurance usually have the right to subrogation, they end up subrogating in that claim if you have it. But if you don't have it, where do you go? What do you do?
Kind of curious
if there's a connection.
Well, it might be. Medicaid is a form of insurance.
Yes, it is.
And Medicaid, I think, does have. I'm a charity hospital. It used to have, you know, one of the things that an attorney general could do is appoint a lawyer for a charity hospital to go
exercise subrogation. Yeah.
Subrogation, which is the right to collect back, basically, for the non-lawyers out there. But I think the fact that we have a large poor population, and over time, lawsuits have been seen as a way that if a poor person gets injured, well, that's one way to collect for pain and suffering and collect a big check. It's, you know, I hate to say it. People say, you know, hit the lottery. But, you know, when I practiced law, I did some plaintiff law, not big time stuff, but I always told my clients, the last thing you want is $1 million claim, because to get that, you got to be in a wheelchair, you know. So, but there are lawyers out there, unfortunately, and I think there's blame to go around, by the way. But there are lawyers
sure.
out there who talk about, I can get you more money, and you know, man, I wouldn't want to have $1 million claim. I really wouldn't.
No,
you know. So, but people. You know, but I had clients who were like, you know, who genuinely were suffering and were in pain. And every lawyer who does plaintiff work has encountered that. So it's, again, it's a very difficult balance. I wish I knew the answer to it. And I've not looked painstakingly at other states like you have. So I'm really curious as to what you found. You know, like I said, I think it's an interesting observation. I think it's partly uninsured or traditionally uninsured, and partly what I talked about in terms of having a large, and we're not talking about different things, a large pool of poor people in Louisiana who, you know, and it's this is something that's measurable. People who are poor probably tend to get in more accidents, whether it's at work or in cars or whatever. It's just a natural. It's not because they're it's not putting blame on them that they're not necessarily at fault, but they tend to have to be in situations where accidents might occur. You know, riding as a passenger with somebody else who may or may not be a good driver, or may or may not have adequate insurance, and are encountering you know, bad roads and things like that. You know, so there's all kinds of reasons for it. There is no the one thing I think we can all agree on, and we should all agree on, is that there is no magic silver bullet out there. You do this and it's going to get better. It's just not that way. It's very complicated.
Well, let's look at this from a political perspective, because I made the observation. I think you have as well. The governor's really taken this and put it squarely on his shoulders, this issue. It's one that I don't think, if you did everything, let's assume that your whatever legislation is there, it's all the right legislation at the right time. My thought is that you may not see results for 2, 3, 4 years, maybe.
Right.
You know, and politically, that's a lifetime.
It is. And that's part of the problem, I suspect, because by the time you might begin to see some positive stuff going on, you get a new legislature and possibly a new governor in there, and they want to change it. And then sometimes the lawyers or the for both sides will try to get the courts to interpret that new law a certain way. And, you know, and the laws are not always, you know, it's the result of the legislative process, which is often compared to sausage making. It comes in one way and it comes out another way, and there might be vagueness in the law or definitions that, you know, are hard to interpret, you know, for judges. So it's It's very difficult to achieve. But you're right. It takes time. If you really want to see if something's going to work, I think you got to give it at least 5 years to really see measurable results.
So I'm applauding for the willingness to consume the political capital, because that's exactly what he's doing. Because I think the delta between now and then, if you see any benefit from this, is incredibly wide, in my view.
I agree. I totally agree. It's just. I wish I had the answer, man. I really do.
Yeah, no, don't we all? Let me ask you this, Clancy. This issue in my mind is kind of overshadowing the fiscal posture of the state of Louisiana right now. I think this is a fiscal session, right? Not much chatter about what's going on, about where we find ourselves monetarily in this state from a budget perspective.
And also let's before we leave the idea of insurance, I did a commentary on Channel 4 not long ago where I said, you know, auto insurance rates are high, but let's not lose sight of property insurance rates, because they are high too. And it's overshadowing that. It's even overshadowing part of the insurance discussion. It's all about auto. Because everybody gets a bill. Every adult with a driver's license gets a bill for auto insurance. Not everybody owns property. And yet, even those who are renters wind up, in many cases, paying the cost of property insurance because they pay it through higher rents. But anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there. But I think you're right. It is, for now, overshadowing the fiscal challenges that the I'm not going to call it a crisis. We're not facing a cliff. But, you know, the failure of proposed Amendment 2 on March 29th puts the state, in a different situation than the governor and many legislators were hoping it would be in or expecting it would be in. And there are some real challenges there. You know, teachers want to get a raise. The governor, you know, and the legislature have a lot of work to do on that. And, you know, that always comes down to the last day or two, as you know.
I suspect they'll find the money for the stipend.
They should.
How they treat that to be interesting is to if they make it permanent or it's just another year of another stipend.
Yeah, because when it's a stipend, it doesn't count towards their retirement. That's something teachers are feeling, you know. And I think there seems to be a move. Correct me if I'm wrong, Newell. I'm not sure if the governor put that money, whether it's permanent or temporary, into his proposed budget. But I know I get the sense that the legislature really wants to do that, because teachers went to bat for Amendment 2. They pushed for it. They worked for it. And, you know, I think they're owed this, if nothing else. We're talking about the politics of it. They're owed it for what they do in the course of being educators. But politically, they're also owed it. I think most legislators, or many legislators, feel that way.
I don't think it was in the original draft of his budget.
I agree. That's my perception of it.
It may be there now. It may have shifted. Yeah. I don't know. But it wasn't what he had originally proposed, which I think that budget, as you've pointed out before, had a lot to do with the assumption that Proposition 2 was going to pass. And when it didn't pass... I don't know that there was a lot of time to go modifying everything that they had already done.
Yeah, but that's what look, it's not like this is a brand new thing either. I mean, this happens all the time. Budgets get proposed and the legislature ultimately decides. I'm thinking that I really believe they're going to get this done. They're going to find a way to make sure that the legislature, the teachers get their money.
Cameron Henry said to me in an interview that it is all but done. So that means he's already taken. He's already figured out what where the votes are and where they're not, right?
Well, so. Right. And Cameron Henry, of course, is from Jefferson Parish. He's president of the Senate, and he and other senators have really been kind of the voices of reason. Not that others are unreasonable, but they've been real. They've been the beacon of hope for a lot of people, for moderation, you know. And I say that as a compliment. Some people think moderation is a sign of weakness. I think it's a sign of strength.
It's a sign of strength, no doubt.
They've stood strong for doing what they think is right in the and looking at the long term, you know, not the immediate, what's right in front of them.
Absolutely. Well, as always, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We truly appreciate it, your insight and your time, and have a great week.
Thank you, Neil. You too. Bye.
Thank you, sir. Clancy Dubose, political editor and columnist for Gambit and WWL Louisiana, political analyst as well. We will be right back with Jeff Nowak. We'll do a little Saints draft recap. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're joined by Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter and digital content producer. The Saints have finished the 2025 draft. Jeff, welcome to the show. Your thoughts?
Yeah, how you doing, Newell? Long weekend.
It was a long weekend. I guess I'll start off. You obviously are the expert. You know a hell of a lot more than this than I do. But as I went through each and every one of these players and a breakdown of where they've been, what they've accomplished, what they've done, I kind of like this group. I don't know. I mean, they seem to have proven themselves.
Yeah. Well, one thing that kind of became clear throughout the process is I think the Saints, you know, in a lot of instances were looking for kind of proven, productive players, and that's what you got. The running back that got out of Kansas is their all-time leading rusher. He had 16 rushing touchdowns each of the past two seasons. That's Devin Neal, the linebacker out of Oklahoma, Danny Stutzman, and the safety out of Virginia, Johan Sanker. I mean, they've combined for over 400 tackles each over the past 2 years in their respective environments. So, you know, I think you go up and down the line and you see highly productive players, and I think that's something you were looking at. The other thing, it's a 9-man draft class. You know, they haven't had that big of a draft class since 2015. And then before that, since 2002. So, you know, it's a big number. You know, we've never seen a 10-man draft class in the Mickey Loomis era. So they make the limit at 9. The interesting thing is in all of those draft classes, they ended up drafting a quarterback, which is not a given. The Saints don't draft a quarterback every year. This year, they went for Louisville's Tyler Shuck. You know, it was a bit of a controversial pick in terms of the reaction and the value at that point. I think it's one of those situations where anytime you disagree with a pick, you say, oh, they could have waited and got him later. We'll never know. But I think it's pretty telling that whenever it's always people that disagree with a pick that tend to say, ah, you could have got him later. It's not, you don't know that. You can't know that. You wait 31 picks, he's probably not there. The more realistic scenario would be, maybe you could have waited a little bit, get another player there, and trade up to get him from where you were at 71. But I don't think this Saints team was one that was really keen on giving away a ton of assets. I think when you're changing schemes, you're changing offenses, you're changing defenses, I need to add pieces. The quicker I can kind of turn over with players that fit the schemes I'm bringing in, the faster you can kind of reach your peak. Yeah, you know, your peak efficiency in those new schemes, because that's the thing that a lot of people don't take into account. You want to change from a 4-3 to a 3-4. You need the pieces to do that. And, you know, you'll make do in year one if you don't have the perfect roster for what you're trying to do. But you're not going to be playing at the level that you could be if you had what you needed to have in there. So I think that's what it was that I appreciated about this class. You had 9 different picks. I mean, you had 9 picks. 9 different positions, each one kind of filled a need that I think the Saints had. And that's how a team rebuilds, right? That's how a team that's missed the playoffs over the past 4 years kind of rebuilds the core group that can sustain winning over the course of time. Like, you go back to that 2017 draft class, hitting on all those picks, and 2016 before that, people forget that draft, but that's the one you got Michael Thomas and David Onyemata and Von Bell There's one other guy in there that I can't recall. But, you know, that's where those two drafts are what kind of drove that run of success from 2017 through 2020. A lot of those guys are gone now, right? Alvin Kamara is basically the only guy from that 2017 class. Ryan Ramczyk retired. Everyone else is, you know, somewhere else. You know, Marshawn Lattimore is in Washington. Trey Hendrickson is in Cincinnati. But you got to bring in those players. You got to hit on those draft picks to sustain success. And so that's what you're hoping. You're hoping that these guys that got in the mid rounds can be contributors early on and develop into team leaders and Pro Bowl caliber players. You got the quarterback that is a little older, and there's some criticism around that, but he's a more pro-ready guy than I think they've had at the quarterback position in terms of young players in a long while. So now I agree with you. I like this draft class. I think there's some sneaky good picks in there. You can argue with the value at some of the spots, but in general, I think you've got a lot of players that you expect to contribute for the long term.
Yeah, I don't understand the controversy over the quarterback. I don't know. Again, you know more than I do, but I like having a 6'5 quarterback. I'm just going to say it. I think there's a lot. And then this guy played for three separate, pretty serious programs, right? Louisville, Texas Tech, Oregon. And he produced right off the bat every time. Coming in, you know, he was behind a first-round draft pick quarterback in Oregon, comes in, makes a difference, and repeats that performance over and over and over again. Pretty telling to me.
I think the discourse around Tyler Shuck is interesting because it's a very social media generation type criticism of when you have two or three kind of catchy negatives to point out, then everything else kind of falls to the background because, hey, I found this clip of him making a bad play at the combine. I'm going to post that, and it's going to be shared and shared to oblivion. And the fact that he had the best quarterback workout of anyone at the combine is completely forgotten about because he had kind of one funky throw where he was trying something, looked like the ball slipped out of his hand. This is your quarterback. So, and that becomes the conversation. So the points about Tyler that everyone hinges on, he's 25 years old. He's older. He was in college for 7 years. Now, I think the Saints view that as a positive because you have at the quarterback.
Look, I don't know nothing. I think it is.
Right. So you have a veteran guy that understands the game, that has a more pro-ready situation and understanding than someone who's coming in at 21 years old, right? So the age is something that, yeah, sure, you would probably like a quarterback that you could mold a little more. But at the same time, he comes in a little more ready to step in. So there's a give and take there. The other thing that people hinge on is the season-ending injuries, right? So, you know, he started at Oregon. He backed up Justin Herbert, eventually ended up at Texas Tech. Now, Texas Tech had an offense where they wanted him to run around a lot, right? They wanted him to run QB power and he was taking hits. And when you're doing that to a quarterback, injuries are much – I mean, look at Taysom Hill, right? If you're going to operate like Taysom Hill does, you're going to get hurt. And that's what you saw. He didn't have any ACL tears. Right. There was no Kellen Moore describes it as non-orthopedic injuries. And I think that's significant. If you've ever broken a bone, you know, it's painful. It's difficult. But, you know, the bone heals and you're back. It's a lot different than a full repair of your knee and cartilage. And, you know, that takes months and months in rehab and you got to strengthen stuff around it. And, you know, it's a collarbone. It heals your back, a knee or a fibula. It breaks. It heals your back. But that's what people are talking about. And you rarely hear people get to, okay, but, you know, he's 6'5". He's got a cannon arm. He's accurate. He's athletic. He has a really good feel to slide out of the pocket, keep his shoulders square downfield, and make big plays in big moments, extend plays. But we don't hear about that. We hear about, you know, the age and the injuries and a couple bad throws at the combine and maybe some rough decisions under pressure, and suddenly he's not worth talking about because Shedeur Sanders is the social media icon, and that's who they should be going after, not the guy who has all the traits you want at the quarterback position. So I think once people see him out there and they kind of get the picture of what he looks like as a quarterback, I think people will get on board. But right now it's like, well, we didn't take the most popular name. You reached, quote unquote, reached. And so there you are. But I do find it interesting. Michael Penix spent 6 years in college, came out after two ACL tears, is going to be 2025 in 2 weeks. And we never hear about his age. We never really hear about his injuries. Both these guys are going to be 25 in 2 weeks on May 8th when Michael Penix turns turns 25. And so I just think it's interesting. You hear all about Tyler Shuck's age and injuries, but you never hear about Michael Penix's age and injuries. Bo Nix, Jaden Daniels, all these guys came out later in their careers. It's not a negative at the quarterback position. We're going to be playing into your mid-30s if you're any good. So I know that's a long answer, but that's kind of where I land on the quarterback. And I just hope people give him a chance because I think there's a lot to like there.
No, I do too. Your thoughts about all of these folks, some of them had injuries. I mean, you play in these big-time colleges, you're going to get hurt. I mean, getting through 4 or 5 years of college football and not getting hurt is I don't know that there are many people like that, but we have a couple that we've drafted that actually were able to achieve same. But these folks look very durable and flexible and able to take the hits and continue on and come back from injuries and perform at a high level yet again.
Yeah, well, it's not, you know, Kellen Moore, Mickey Loomis, one of the first things out of their mouths when they're talking about Tyler and is the adversity he went through and kind of learned from. Tyler will say the same thing, and that's a benefit. Like, you want to have some adversity when you enter, when you're going through that process, you can learn what it's like, right? Like, he knows what a season-ending injury and that frustration can be like. He knows what it's like to work back from that. And, you know, I think that's when you talk about the draft, so much of it comes down to, do you have highlight plays? You know, what are people saying about you? And we often ignore, you know, one of the bigger parts of this process is sitting down with a guy and talking to him and learning about him and figuring out whether he's a guy you want in your locker room. But I assure you, that is a very important part of the Saints process. And they said the same thing about Kelvin Banks at number 9 overall. Like, you're talking about high character, high quality players. And we'll see. And it doesn't hurt when you have the production. Now, one other thing I'll add about Tyler Shuck, you know, when he put him in a pro-style offense with Jeff Brohm, one of the better quarterback teachers you'll find at the college level, he didn't have injuries, right? You know, yeah. He made it through that season. And one of the things Jeff said when we talked to him was after the draft was, you know, we didn't have him running QB power. We didn't have him diving headfirst into a charging linebacker. And that's a good way to keep a quarterback healthy. So I think that's, you know, I don't expect that injury history to really kind of be an issue beyond, you know, if you understand, hey, I don't need to be taking as much contact as I did in those Texas Tech offenses, and I know how to operate when they're in a pro-style system and inside the pocket, then that's a benefit.
Yeah. You know, you never really know, right, with a draft how things are going to turn out, but I think they kind of aligned who they drafted to overcome some of the unpleasant truths that they're dealing with the present roster. And, you know, when you kind of look at that alignment in who they drafted where, I think they set out to accomplish what they needed to. I don't know who's grading these things, saying I think somebody said there were a B minus at best this draft. I don't know how you get there, but for what it's worth, if no one's listening to me about it, I think they did a good job.
Yeah, you know, I know there's always going to be guys that I wish they could have got him. I wish they could have got him at number 40. There was a few guys that I really liked that I would have loved to see in a Saints uniform. You know, Will Johnson, the cornerback, Donovan Ezra-Rock, the edge rusher. But you can't draft everybody. You can only draft the guys that you pick at your pick. You know, I would have loved to see them have 10 picks at the top of the second round. That's just not how it works. So I think
you and the Saints both.
Right. And it's impossible to grade a draft class in the day after the draft. Everyone wants to see it, so people do it. But everyone would tell you it takes 2 to 3 years to have even a semblance of an idea of who won the draft. So, you know, I'm rooting for a lot of these guys. I'm excited to see them get on the field in the next couple of weeks at the rookie minicamp.
Absolutely. Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter, digital content producer. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great week.
No doubt. You too.
All right, folks, we'll be right back. Stay with us. And, you know, a lot of folks on the text line saying that we should have taken Shador at one point in time. It all depends on the offensive scheme that you're going to run and whether or not that's somebody that you really want to take a chance on. I think the downside to Shador may have possibly been the manner in which he conducts himself. The Saints have always historically looked for leaders, credible leaders. It's one thing to be a leader. It's something entirely different. You're in a different stratosphere when you're a credible leader. And I remember something that Colin Powell said about credible leaders. And it was in response to a reporter's question about what it is. And he says, you know you're a credible leader when men and women will follow you into the bowels of darkness, if for no other reason other than curiosity. Think about that for a minute. And, you know, historically, the saints have tried to collectively put together a group of folks that have exhibited the characteristics of credible leaders. There's no doubt they hit the mark, right, with Drew Brees. You know, he did it not only in an overt way, he did it very much in a covert way as well, by setting a standard of his work habit, his practice habits, this, that, and otherwise. So there's a whole lot of this, science, I think, that's out there about that we don't see, is not readily apparent, right? When we're watching the draft from afar, we're not there in the interviews, we're not hearing these young men's life story, the adversity that they've had to overcome, what they've dealt with in their childhood, their upbringing, what odds they've had to beat back to get to where they have. I mean, when you look at the breakdown of these nine young men and what they've accomplished by setting record after record after record, you know, that in and of itself is pretty damn impressive, quite frankly. And I'm sure every team's got the same. And now you move on to the next, stage of this as to whether or not they can bring the successes that they had at the collegiate level up their game and be able to do so, develop the work habit, learn from the coaches, and gain a better understanding of the nuances of the professional game, which are very different than the nuances of a collegiate game. Because at this level, everybody is even faster than what you've been up against, because the pool is shrinking, right? The number of collegiate players to the number of professional players. So you're playing against the creme de la creme. And you never know how that's going to turn out till they walk on that field and they battle each and every day. Some days you're going to battle in a much better fashion than others. It's human nature. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. I think the stars are going to align for a number of these folks, hopefully all of them, quite frankly, and we're able to have more wins than losses. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We're going to talk about a number of different things that are impacting the economy. And this week, there are a lot of measures that come out, and we'll see exactly what the tariff impact has been on this economy. Stay with us.